So we're reading today from the Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita Madhya Leela, Chapter 7, which is entitled The Lord's Tour of South India. So text 100 and 101. Text 100. Each of these empowered persons would return to his own village, always chanting the holy name of Krishna, and sometimes laughing, crying, and dancing. 101. Translation by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. Such an empowered person would request everyone and anyone, whomever he saw, to chant the holy name of Krishna. In this way, all the villagers would also become devotees of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Purport. In order to become an empowered preacher, one must be favored by Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu or his devotee, the spiritual master. One must also request everyone to chant the Maha Mantra. In this way, such a person can convert others to Vaishnavism, showing them how to become pure devotees of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Srila Prabhupada ki. Om Jnanati Miranyasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yaina Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Namo Om Vishnu Vaya Krishna Krishna. This is a very nice chapter in the Madhya Leela, Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita. In the previous chapter, the Lord delivered Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. We read that pastime in great detail over many weeks and months. And now, having taken the permission and blessings of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, Lord Nityananda, and the other senior associates in that area, Lord Chaitanya is embarking on a most famous part of his pastimes, his tour of South India. And this tour of South India is very, very special. Some of the acharyas have described that in this South India tour, he displayed mercy which he didn't do when he was in the Mayapur area, in Navadvip area. Something extra special flowed from Mahaprabhu on this tour of South India. And we see the results of that because so many wonderful incidents took place. Just in the last couple of verses, it was described how Mahaprabhu traveled. It says that chanting this verse, which is Krishna, 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 hey, chanting this verse, Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, known as Gaura Hari, went on his way. As soon as he saw someone, he would request him to chant, Hari, Hari. Whoever heard Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu chant Hari Hari also chanted the holy name of Lord Hari and Krishna. In this way, they all followed the Lord, very eager to see him. After some time, the Lord would embrace these people and bid them return home, having invested each of them with spiritual potency. Each of these empowered persons would return to his own village, always chanting the holy name of Krishna and sometimes laughing, crying, and dancing. So it's almost like a viral activity. Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is empowering individuals with the potency to distribute the same to many other people. And these days on social media, an exciting message comes and half the village knows about it within a few moments. So similarly, this is a similar activity. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, by his extra special potency, would embrace different persons, induce them to chant, give them his darshan, and they, fully empowered and invested with spiritual potency, would then be able to do the same themselves. Now, this is one of the special things that happens when the Supreme Lord is personally present. When he's present, certain things are accelerated. And what he can achieve, in a very visible way, is also many, many times greater than what typically happens. So all Lord Chaitanya has to do is just to embrace one person and they are immediately infused with love of God. They start chanting, dancing, crying out of ecstasy. They do not need to undergo lengthy periods, lengthy bhakti training, lengthy 7-day monk experiences, or even longer courses, and we offer many of those as well. But rather instantly, with the Lord's presence, one is infused and enlivened, their entire life's purpose is fulfilled. And with great conviction and confidence, they carried on distributing that same love that they had received. And so, therefore, it's described that each of these persons would go back to their own village, having met Mahaprabhu. They would chant, they would dance with full faith. And that's what's very interesting. He said that only an empowered person can actually do this. With the Lord's potency, we all know that the activities are available to us. The activities of reading the scripture, chanting the Lord's holy name, having the chance to inquire from other devotees, to engage in the satsang, to enjoy kirtan together, as we've been doing all morning. These are the activities of Krishna consciousness. And practically anyone can do them. As Prabhupada said, even a child can chant Hare Krishna. It doesn't require any special expertise. No training, no university degree. Anyone can chant. It's a very simple activity. Anyone can dance. These are all natural traits within every human being, to sing and to dance. Yet there is also a little hidden ingredient which we need if this is going to happen properly. Because on an external level, we can do external activities. But when they come from the heart, we need to be empowered by the Lord. And that is something that the Lord does when He wants. It's not something that we can demand. We can't say to the Lord, "Dear Lord, I have been chanting all day today. I must be fully empowered now." Or, "I've been chanting for a whole year. Or maybe even 20 years. I'm a mature devotee in Krishna consciousness. And I've survived 20 years of chanting. You must be very pleased with me." Well, the Lord may be very pleased with us. That's true. Because He is always very happy when He sees a conditioned living entity finally taking shelter of the lotus feet of Srila Prabhupada, who then directs them to the wonderful, auspicious form of Lord Sri Krishna and His divine entourage. Sri Sri Radha Gopalanam Naki. So the Supreme Lord is certainly very happy to see that pastime, that effect taking place. After wandering in this universe for lifetimes, something that we cannot readily perceive in our conditioned state, we eventually get a chance to learn the trick for escaping from this predicament. And if we by chance grab that and we engage in some practice, show some determination, the Lord supplies us with all facility to progress. And when we come to the temple, when we engage in, or when we embark on Krishna consciousness, for most people it's quite a mystical experience. Something has to happen. The Lord has done something to permit that next step. Before devotees come to the temple, perhaps for some of you who have just completed the 7-day program as they announced in the morning, there were probably countless other opportunities for you to come to the temple in the past. You've probably seen the devotees chanting and dancing in the streets, probably wondered what that was all about, possibly even laughed at them, as we all did when we first saw devotees chanting, dancing, carefree, spreading the glories of the holy names. But something has happened, because at a certain point, the Lord has facilitated a sequence of interactions, maybe meetings, maybe books, maybe something special, something inside each one of us. Maybe a special circumstance. Sometimes the Lord has to arrange a circumstance for us to take spiritual life more seriously or to embark on that path in great seriousness. We've had the same facilities before, but now something has been opened. It's as if we've been given entrance. So when that has happened, that is a sign of the Lord's mercy. And it is something to be taken with great gravity and great appreciation. Because out of countless many people who are still engaged in their normal mundane lives, with no real benefit to come from an ever-increasing engagement of satisfying the senses, ultimately we know there's no real benefit. We go through a whole lifetime doing that. We study for years, learning how to lead a happy, fulfilled material life. Then we engage in that material life. We raise a family, we get a job, we may earn money, we may go somewhere. You may do all of these things. And at the end of it, what has been the achievement? Yes, we functioned. We've eaten. We've clothed ourselves. We've walked around. We've engaged in all the activities of eating, mating, sleeping, and defending. These are things that people do. Everyone does, and all animals do them as well. There's nothing particularly glorious about such a life. This is what the scriptures explain, that a life lived like this is no better or no different in one sense than the life lived by every single living entity in this world. And at the end of it, if you count what is the achievement, well, you probably have a large pile of rubbish that you've created during your life. A certain chunk of a landfill has been reserved for our contribution to society. Large amounts of stuff has been deposited there. That's our contribution. What else is left? Not much. Maybe if you are a philosopher or a thinker, you may have produced some books. Maybe those are left for some time. If you happen to be skilled in another way, maybe you've produced a few records. Maybe you've left some grand buildings. That's been... I'm just thinking of the different things that outlive us. Practically everything else disappears with us. Our albums, our possessions, our memories, they all go with us. And we leave behind a few things. And as we know, inevitably, this is the age of decay, and in the material world, decay is a constant companion. Everything that we leave also decays. Srila Prabhupada described that our efforts in this material world are like building sandcastles on the beach. We make a gigantic construction, maybe very elaborate. They sometimes have sandcastle competitions with turrets and flags and all sorts of wonderful decorative items. But then, as soon as the tide comes in, it's gone within a few moments. No one knows the next year that we built the sandcastle. So similarly, this can be described. This is one way to describe our journey in this material world. We come, we function for some time, and then we leave. And was there anything achieved? We felt some happiness, we felt some distress. We may have helped some others, we may have harmed some others. What's the consequence of all that? The consequence of all of that is our next destination. The activities that we have performed in this life lead to our next destination. At the time of death, which is an inevitability that comes to everyone, we all know that this body disappears. But we don't see what remains, because that's not so detectable with our blunt vision or our blunt senses. What's left is the subtle body. Subtle body consists of the mind, intelligence, and false ego, the identity that allows us to function within this world. And that subtle body encloses the spirit soul, which is our real existence, our real essence. Now that little package moves to its next destination, which has been accrued due to a certain mental state developed during this life and in combination with previous lives. To fit that particular mentality, level of intelligence, and a particular brand of false ego, we are given a new external body. And in that external body, and it may not be a human body, it could be an animal body, or even in a lower modes of ignorance, even a plant body, which doesn't offer much opportunity for any type of progress. We can see as one goes higher up through the animal species, there is a progressively higher level of mental faculty, intellectual awareness. But still, it's not really much, even at the topmost species of animals. The ability to inquire, the ability to intellectually understand, the ability to follow with discipline beyond our natural instinct is definitely not manifest very strongly in animals. That is only available in humans. That's a luxury that's given in the human body. We have the chance, we have the faculties to actually inquire, who am I? What am I doing here? All my life I've been engaged in activities. I've experienced happiness, I've suffered. Now what? Is the rest of my life going to be the same as this? A dose of happiness, a dose of suffering, a dose of pain, a dose of pleasure? Or is there something else? This is only possible in the human life. And so different people, to satisfy this urge, adopt different philosophies, different faiths, different religions, different paths. And what is really meant by actually adopting the Vaishnava path? It is said here that wherever Mahaprabhu went, he would empower everyone to chant the holy name of Krishna. And Prabhupada says that such an empowered way, such an empowered person, can induce many others to Vaishnavism. And so what is this Vaishnavism which we are suggesting or is being portrayed here as something worth having? Is it just another ism within the whole supermarket of isms that are available? It's unlimited isms that will satisfy every person's desire, their social needs, their hobbies, their habits. What is the trait of Vaishnavism, if you like? Well, Vaishnav is a person who is connected to Lord Vishnu. It worships Lord Vishnu, loves Lord Vishnu, and understands that their identity cannot be separated really from the Lord's. Their purpose, their life, their existence is intimately connected to the Supreme Lord. That is a Vaishnava. That is a person. And so the scriptures explain how we can actually make a connection with that Supreme Person. Throughout the different faiths of the world, the Lord is approached in different ways. First on a platform of subservience. That one is subservient to the all-powerful Lord. That is a common trait, right? In all faiths. That we bow down before the Lord because He's great, and if we don't, we'll be punished. I'm sure you've heard that also. Various individuals may have pointed out that you will soon be going to hell unless you do X, Y, and Z that they're promising. And I'm sure many people, like myself, have probably had enough of such statements. There is definitely more to it than that. That is a preliminary level of faith. That this is the Supreme Lord, He's the Lord and Master, and unless you do what He says, you're in big trouble. So that fear-based approach to spiritual life is only one element, one aspect. Another layer is the platform of duty, whereby we recognize the Lord's mercy towards us during our lives. The fact that despite all our great endeavors, our industrial expertise, we still didn't create the air. We didn't create the water. We didn't create the land. Food, subsistence is all supplied by nature, with or without our farming expertise. The Lord has supplied all of these things to us, which are the basis for our fundamental existence. Yet people in an increasingly scientifically oriented world have gone down the path of ever-increasing atheism, where they adopt for themselves a sort of status which goes beyond their actual achievements. Ultimately, it's the Lord. He supplies the sunlight. He supplies the rain. He supplies the wind. None of us did that. No enterprise on this planet did that. Rather, we've done much to disrupt those natural processes. This is becoming a hot topic these days. So our contribution in that sense isn't anything great. We have to acknowledge the supremacy of the Lord, because, yes, He is supreme. Factually, He is supreme. And so this platform of duty is one where we appreciate that the Lord sustains us and has done so for our entire lives. And then out of gratitude for that, we try to render some service to Him. We do something to try to please Him. That is concept, something that we do out of duty, almost as an obligation. You've done so much for me. Now I must do something for you. It can be as simple as acknowledging thanks for food before we eat it. Christians say grace to acknowledge that it's the Lord's effort, the Lord's doing that has provided us these items. So that is a very nice platform. The platform where you acknowledge the Lord's presence and thank Him for it, and therefore do something for Him. And then there is a higher category of interaction with the Lord, and that is the platform of love. On that platform of love, it is not so much a business relationship. Dear Lord, you give me this, and I'll give you this. Keep me nice and happy, keep me wealthy, healthy, all the rest, empowered, and I will come to you and pray on Sundays. At least I will do this once or twice a year. That's the kind of contract. But on the platform of love, such a contract isn't so important. On the platform of love, we recognize that the Lord is not only the supreme provider of everything, but He's also the supreme companion of every single living entity. The Supreme Lord is the source, the sustainer. It is to Him ultimately that all offerings are to be made. When one understands that He's the supplier and is the repository of all our efforts, then one obtains real peace. If we don't understand the Lord's presence in our lives and our connection with Him, it is very difficult for us to obtain peace. Sounds such a simple statement. It is simple. That peace can only be had when we are connected to the source of all peace, the Lord. Otherwise, we are running here and there amidst the products that this material world supplies, trying to extract something which they are incapable of providing. If our nature is spiritual, then it doesn't seem likely that any number of material objects is going to satisfy that spiritual hunger. You need something of a spiritual nature to satisfy a spiritual hunger. And this is what Lord Chaitanya is doing. This spiritual hunger that we have is a natural state. In our natural state, we are friends with the Lord. We are His worshippers. We love Him. Why? Because He is our dearmost object. He's the dearmost person in our lives. Yes, He's very powerful, but we largely forget that when we're in a relationship with Him. Yes, in a relationship, you know, there may be differences. A child and a parent are not the same. Parent is more powerful, more knowledgeable, provides. The child is weak, relatively. Yet the child doesn't think, oh, my greatly powerful father, I must be constantly in fear and quaking before him. No, there's a relationship of love there. There's an interaction. So similarly with us and the Supreme Lord, who ultimately is the Supreme Father, Aham Bija Pradapita, says, I am the seed-giving father of all living entities. And so with that, we can also have a very nice, loving relationship. Now, establishing that relationship is a little tricky, because for lifetimes, we've been trying to avoid it. We've been trying to avoid turning to the Lord, turning instead to other sources of pleasure, seeming pleasure. We've been wandering here and there through different species, trying to get a little taste of something. And each species offers you something different. The abilities of most animals are greater than humans, you know, from a sensory perspective. Eagles have very intense, precise eyesight. Puts us to shame. Many animals can run much faster than we can. There's nothing particularly special about our physical body. It's rather mediocre in terms of the relative to the rest of the animals. It can do far more elaborate things. Really, the only saving grace for humans is our intelligence. Our intelligence, the ability to engage in discussions which transcend the body, and our ultimate ability to connect with the Lord through devotional service. An animal cannot render devotional service because it neither has the ability, the paraphernalia, nor the intellect to do so. But we can. We can render service. And so this term that Srila Prabhupada used, devotional service, is very interesting. On the platform of love, yes, if you love someone, you can go around all day saying, I love you, I love you, I love you. That's okay. But they also expect that when it's time for their birthday or when, you know, they need something, that you should actually also do something. Just saying I love you is not quite a substitute. So the love always has to be expressed. So therefore Prabhupada coined this term, devotional service. Where there's service, it is a fundamental feature of any loving reciprocation. We serve others all day, every day, in our lives anyway. If you're an employee, you're serving the company, you're serving the bosses. If you're in a family, you're a child, you're supposed to be carrying out the wishes of the parents, going through all that education. As a parent, you're rendering constant service to the child, caring, looking after them, clothing them, feeding them, dealing with their tantrums. Service is constantly exchanged. It's a facet, it's a symptom of love. And so it seems reasonable that if we are attempting to develop our love for the Lord, then there will be some service involved. And that service is a mood of offering something to Krishna. Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnusmaranam, Padasevanam, Archanam, Vandanam, Dasyam, Sakyam, Atmani, Vedanam. These are 9 processes described, which are ways that we can serve the Lord. Shravanam and Kirtanam, the 2 most prominent ones. Hearing about the glories of the Lord, that is a service also. And then speaking the glories of the Lord. Speaking the glories of the Lord, as we are doing now, talking about the Lord's pastimes, his philosophy. Then singing, as we did, singing the glories of the Lord, chanting his holy names. These are the 2 most important processes, which help us very much in our quest for smaranam, remembrance. To keep the Lord in our consciousness. To be thinking of the Lord, his pastimes, his name, his fame, his form. In the spiritual world, the Lord's various manifestations are considered equivalent. In the spiritual realm, when the Lord's holy name is chanted, there is a complete manifestation of his form, his features, his pastimes and activities. Now that's a concept which is a little alien to us in this material world. Because here we understand there is a difference between a person's name and the person themselves. In the spiritual world, in the spiritual realm, such distinctions are not manifest in that way. There is a massive variety, an unlimited variegatedness of expression, of activity, of service. And the holy name is really that inspiring, or that the seed for that spiritual world to manifest. This is why so much is made of the holy name. We chant the holy name. When we go on the streets, we give people the holy name. It's because it's very, very special and very potent. Lord Chaitanya, who is Krishna himself, who appeared 500 years ago, came specifically to propagate the holy name. We've just been reading how the Lord himself propagated the holy name when he was here. He would chant the holy name, induce someone to chant Hari Hari, and immediately they would be invested with potency, and then they would continue chanting. Now we've been given access to that same potency by the mercy of our founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada, the mercy of all of the other Acharyas who have come before him, ultimately heading all the way back to Lord Chaitanya, Lord Nityananda, and back to Lord Krishna. By the mercy of that chain, because the Lord's secrets, the Lord's techniques are also delivered through his devotees. So that confidential matter is actually brought to us through the chain which comes directly from the Lord. That's why it has special potency. This is not something that the Lord concocted. I mean, whatever the Lord concocts, it's bound to be something extra special anyway. But this is not a concoction of the Lord or the devotees. The authenticity of the chanting of the Lord's names can be traced right back to the beginning, right back to Krishna himself, right back to the spiritual world. Apanaha samsritim ghoram yannama vivasho granam tato satyo vimucheta yat vibheti swayam bhayam. It's described that persons who are entangled in the complicated meshes of birth and death can be immediately freed simply by unconsciously chanting the holy name of Krishna, which is feared by fear personified. Just consider that. There is great power there. We are entangled in these complicated meshes of birth and death. What does that mean? As I mentioned, that our activities in this life will produce for us a situation, a body, circumstances in our next life. We may be born with a silver spoon in our mouth. We may be a pauper. We may have nothing. We may be an animal. That is all determined by this and previous lives. And you can see that equation. The activities, the piety, the impiety that we have accrued in previous lives will result in the life we're living now and what we will have in the future. It's a complex equation. What did you do to this person 3 lifetimes ago that is now going to fructify now with a certain reaction coming your way from that person in a different body. And you consider all the interactions we've had in our lifetime, this life, it's mind-boggling. I'd be impressed if anyone could actually remember all the interactions they've had. We can barely remember what we did last week, let alone everything in this life. Then compound that with everything we did in previous lives. It's a complex equation, and it's very entangling. Because whatever you do now in this life is going to create for you a new situation. A situation of pleasure or a situation of pain. Therefore it is termed complicated meshes. To escape from this is very difficult, but it is possible with the Holy Name. And this is why the Lord is so merciful. He gives us this chance, because by chanting the Holy Name, something special happens. We awaken, and you may have heard this phrase, our dormant love for God. Krishna consciousness is not something that we receive as a dogmatic activity. It's not a process of conversion, whereby now that you've been converted to a Vaishnav, you now have to follow this set of rituals, adopt this ideology, you perform this set of social customs, you wear this dress, you do this. Some of those elements will be part of it, definitely. But that's not it. It's not adoption of a set of rituals, customs, culture, language, tradition, etc. That is a subservient principle. What is actually happening is that we are awakening our dormant love for God. Savaipum sam paro dharmo yato bhaktir adokshaje ahitukya pratihata yayatma suprasiddhati. It's described that the supreme occupation for all humanity, not of any particular caste, color, creed, or whatever, race, religion, the supreme occupation for all humanity is that by which one can render service uninterrupted, unmotivated, to the supreme transcendent Lord. That's the ultimate definition of religion. And you can see the scope of that. That scope is broad and includes every single living entity. Now, through different faiths in this world, each living entity may well be engaging in some level of service to the Lord. And that is good. So when we have an understanding of this mood of becoming a Vaishnava, we are referring to this principle of awakening our natural inbuilt propensity to serve the Lord, rather than learning a set of external activities which we then do, and then we dogmatically try to impose on others. That is why a sincere devotee, a true Vaishnav, will never declare their greatness or their advancement of devotional service, because they know it has absolutely nothing to do with external expression, external, strength, external charisma, boasting. No serious person will ever do that. The relationship with Krishna is a completely internal relationship. The individual soul is in direct connection to their supreme lovable object, Krishna. So you will never find a member of a genuine faith, a genuine practitioner of the faith. And in each faith, there are some genuine practitioners. They tend to be a minority in all faiths. You have the general masses who do the dogma. They do the dogma, the rituals, and the rest of it. And there is always a minority who are actually deep, sincere followers of the Lord. That is really what we are aspiring to be. We're aspiring to be one of those persons who turns to the Lord, understands that we have done a lot of mischief in all our adventures in this world, and takes this massive opportunity that the Lord is giving to chant His holy names and to engage in a pure lifestyle, a lifestyle where we follow simplicity, where we follow the principle of non-violence to other living entities, who are, after all, His parts and parcels. He's the father of them too, not just us. And if you have siblings, then would they be harming each other, killing each other, fighting amongst each other, if they're ultimately trying to please the same father? So that is what really becoming a Vaishnav means. That is what it means to actually convert to Vaishnavism. It means we convert our perverted mentality that drives us simply to look for enjoyment amongst objects of this world, and change it from that mentality to wanting to serve the Supreme Lord. Serve the Supreme Lord, serve His mission, serve those who are serving the Supreme Lord. Lord Chaitanya chanted and empowered other living entities, and He empowered them to empower others. And so the process continues. And it is the same with us. We hear something about Krishna consciousness. We first of all understand it. We understand it. We explore it. We challenge. We ask questions. We ask, how is this the case? All our scriptures are actually question and answer books. Bhagavad Gita is a set of questions and answers. It's not a dogmatic set of instructions. Listen to this and keep quiet. No. The prime speaker, Arjuna, is questioning Krishna practically about everything he says. He says, how is this the case? How is that the case? That's our process. We question, we understand, we explore the philosophy, and we start practicing simple life. That simple life gives us a basis for whatever we do in the world. It gives us a grounding. It gives us a focus. But ultimately, my focus, my endeavors, all the endeavors I do in this world, at least some of them, should result in something for the Lord. There should be some expression towards the Lord as a result of all my efforts. Said dharma svanushtita punsam vishvaksena kathasuya notpadayet yadi ratim shrama eva hi kevalam. It said that all the activities, all the dharmas, all the religions, all the work, the occupation that we do is considered to be so much useless labor unless it results in attraction for the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That attraction, that service, is what will actually free us from the troublesome situation in this world. And so with Mahaprabhu's specific potency, this effect happened very quickly all those years ago. These days we have to exercise a little bit of discipline, but that same potency is still accessible. We understand the philosophy, we exercise some discipline, we chant the holy names in a regulated way, on beads, and also together in kirtan. And that, slowly but surely, transforms us. And eventually Lord Chaitanya will empower us in a way which is not questionable. It will be completely apparent that the Lord is empowering us. So I'll stop there and see if anyone has any questions or comments.
Hare Krishna. I notice when I experience distress and suffering, I tend to blame the Lord and resent Him. I don't see it as mercy. I don't look at myself and look where I'm going wrong. So how do I do that? And how do I understand that that's Krishna's mercy and not... Yeah, thank you.
Yes, the Lord is a convenient person to accept blame. All around the world, people blame Him, actually. He's famous in both ways. He's famous in the sense that He's God and people approach Him. But He's also somewhat infamous as the one who is attributable. He's the one to whom we can attribute our miseries. It's been there since the beginning. Even when the Lord is personally present in His various forms in the planet, persons approach the Lord in this mood. So there's two ways that we can address this point. The first is the factual reality of the situation. Now, the factual reality is that as spirit souls, we're not supposed to be in this body. As spirit souls, we are Satchidananda, full of eternity, bliss, knowledge. That's our nature. We're trapped in this body, which is completely the opposite. It's an unnatural situation. We're not meant to be here. But we're here because we wanted to experience being the Lord and Master independent from the Lord. So therefore He supplied us with the ability to do so. He gave us a body, He gave us ability, He gave us situations. And so each person in this world can try to be the boss in some capacity. In their family, you can try and be the boss of the family. At work, you can try and maneuver yourself up through the chain till you manage to manage a few others or mismanage them, as is often the case. Or you can do something within a social sense, political sense, take responsibility for a country. You can try to be the boss. In the consequences of that, and during our attempt to enjoy things in this world, we inevitably step on others' toes. We cause others distress. We cause them harm. We cause distress to Mother Earth. We cause distress to all the living entities on this earth. That has a consequence. That has a consequence for us in the next life, future lives, many lives thereafter. That all those persons that we have caused distress to, they will be entitled at some point to unleash that on us. Even if they don't do it, some other mechanism will deliver it to us. It could be the nature. It could be through a volcano. It could be through an earthquake. It could be through some natural disaster. So a very mature way to approach the sufferings that we go through in this life is to understand the source of them. And this is about taking responsibility in life. Ultimately, we are responsible. Now that is not something that is very palatable to most people. It's something that you cringe a little bit when you hear. Because the idea that I am responsible for every bad thing that's happened to me, maybe this horrendous disease, maybe this long drawn out legal case, maybe this situation of great poverty that I'm thrown in, we think, it's him or it's her or it's this or it's that. And ultimately, it's God. Eventually, it goes back to God. If he's really in charge, it's ultimately him. So a certain maturity of understanding of the philosophy is important as well. And that's why, although it may seem a little bit arduous, one of our main activities is to give out books. You know, so some of you may have received a book on the street. Some of you may have bought a book when you come to the temple. Because within the books, we understand some philosophy. We understand something about this world. We understand five topics, actually, from the Gita. We understand this world, material nature. We understand time, which we are all under the control of. We understand ourselves as spiritual living entities and not the body. We understand the Supreme Lord, Ishvara, who is also there as part of this whole scheme. And then we also understand karma, activities that we engage in when we're in this world. This is a fairly methodical development that is required for us to understand how everything works together. We do activities in this body as the spirit soul under the influence of time. That's called an activity, something you do over a period of time. But how and why? There's some understanding behind that too. And the environment, what does material nature supply to you now? What will she supply tomorrow? What does she supply in different countries? Even different planets potentially. That requires a little understanding. So therefore the philosophy teaches us how the spirit soul interacts with a world of matter, which is made up of multiple elements, five gross elements, subtle elements. And this is described in great detail in the Bhagavad Gita and the Srimad Bhagavatam. And in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, this philosophy is churned. And we're given understandable portions of it. So the first way is to actually understand how the mechanism works. Often when you understand the mechanism, it makes more sense. If you understand why it is that you've got heart disease, and understand that it might have something to do with your cholesterol levels, or your lack of exercise, or your smoking, or your excessive fat consumption, or whatever, you might be not so disturbed when the heart attack actually comes. There'll be some understanding behind it. You know, you've lived a life avoiding what you're supposed to be doing. Then if you get it, it's not a major shock. So similarly, if we understand how the mechanism works, we can be more grounded as we approach it. The second dimension is the dimension of a sort of a spiritual seeker who's actively trying to move forward. And in that dimension, we understand that ultimately all our suffering is meant to rectify us in an ultimate sense. That ultimately, through experiencing pain and pleasure, we eventually have enough of it. We start to question, how do I exit this cycle of pain? And that drives us as an impetus to find out more about the Lord and spiritual life. Now, in that process, we understand that having come to spiritual life, we haven't yet achieved perfection. We've just embarked on the process of spiritual life, and there is still some distance to go. We haven't overcome these Anarthas in the heart, lust, anger, greed, envy, pride, all these companions which are responsible for our journey in this material world, we've still got some work to do. We also understand the Lord is very merciful. So what he does is he often gives us a token. We call it token karma. He gives us a token dose of what we're actually supposed to receive, because he sees that we're on a path of rectification and progress. So the need for heavy punishments isn't really there. We have this experience that someone, you know, who's convicted of some crime, they go to jail and their sentence is modified according to their behavior. You know, if they behave well, they follow the reformatory process, the program well, they may well be let out early, because the purpose of that punishment is served. So the Lord also has this in mind, that when he sees we are trying to progress, he starts to reduce the level of suffering that we experience. And he gives us what we consider token karma, a small proportion of what we're due to get. But we're also in an environment where we can now make sense of it. Some people, as you say, develop resentment. And once when there was an earthquake, I think in Brazil or somewhere, you know, these two people they interviewed on television. And one of them was a devout religious person. And they said, "I am so grateful that the Lord has supplied me some vision to see just how dangerous this world is. That these earthquakes, these natural disasters, they can come at any moment. And what is the purpose of all our efforts here? They can just be destroyed in an instant." And then there was another person who said, "Why has God done this to us? My whole life, I've been working so hard. This week, month's work has just been destroyed by this. I hate God. He's always doing this to other people, causing difficulty, giving distress. I don't want anything to do with him." Two persons, same scenario. Exactly the same thing happened to both of them. But these two persons both viewed that incident in a completely different way. That cannot be attributable to God. That is to do with the person's own consciousness. So a person who is trying to progress towards the Lord and is trying to develop a loving relationship with the Lord tries to understand the purpose of this whole system. And it is a system, which is not very nice. Yeah, we do have to say that too. We're not going to candy floss coat, you know, this material world. It is a harsh place. There are rigid laws of material nature. If you jump up, gravity will pull you down, whether you like it or not. If you engage in harmful activities towards one person, you will get that in the future, however unpalatable it may be, or even if you've forgotten all about it. It'll still come. That's the harshness of it. So escaping from that harsh cycle is tricky. But hopefully it also seems very fair. You know that expression, harsh but fair. It's harsh and it's rigid because it's also working to rules. It's not a whimsical flight of fancy for anyone. It's working under rigid rules. And you understand the rules, you work with the rules, you can also escape from those rules. That's the opportunity that's available to us. We can escape from that, from the position of being trapped within this harsh field. So first of all, we understand that our activities are due to us in a very philosophical sense. And then we also understand that whatever we're getting now is a small portion of what we should be getting, what's due to us. So that inspires us to develop gratitude for the Lord. And with that gratitude, we simply patiently tolerate the results of our past misdeeds. And in that is our progress. Eventually we get into a calm, peaceful state where we serve the Lord under any and all circumstances. Devotees have gone through great difficulties in different places, but it doesn't affect them internally. It doesn't affect them. Whatever happens, a medical problem, a social problem, great difficulty. Yes, externally you may have difficulties, but internally there'll be a peace and a satisfaction and a connection with the Lord that is eternal and actually transcends this body and anything that the world can throw at us in this body. So I would say those two points.
Thank you, Hare Krishna.
Okay, so Prabhuji had his hand up, then I'll come to you.
Hare Krishna Prabhu, thank you for the class. I have two small questions. The first one is, in the purport that we read, do we understand that the empowerment by Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is causeless mercy? And is that sort of subjective to time, as in empowerment could be just for a fraction of a second, or it could be for a lifetime? And the other question I had was, in Bhagavad Gita 18:69, Krishna says, there's no servant in this world more dear to me. So what pleases the Lord more, when we distribute his confidential knowledge in the holy name, or when we serve the Vaishnavas?
Yes, with this there's no conflict. It's actually a dangerous path to go down, where you put activities of devotional service into a hierarchy. It can be a subtle form of the ego coming up, that I've embarked on this activity. I'm very good at this particular activity, therefore it is the best. And that's how I motivate myself. I'm doing something better than anyone else. It's dangerous, because it's not the mood of devotional service at all. The Lord has a plan for each person. Each person has different capabilities and abilities, and mentalities also. And he will empower those persons in different ways. He will give them different things to do for him. So what is important is that at a particular moment in time, we engage in the particular service we're rendering to the Lord with as much of our consciousness and wholehearted endeavor as possible. And that will actually become perfect. In the Lord's eyes, that will be perfect. One can speak about the glories of the Lord, one can distribute his books, one can clean the temple, one can worship the deity eventually, one can do many things. One can, you know, take care of Krishna's cows. One can do so many things. Cook for the Lord. Serve the devotees. Help them. These are all elements by which we please the Lord. So there's no hierarchy there. The Lord's mercy comes, to answer your first part, in according to the level of the medicine that we can take. If we're ready to receive a big dose, he can give a big dose, but it might be a little... might be a little too much for us to handle. Because his mercy means a process of rectification of our consciousness. And that requires some work, and that's not easy. If we get too much correction in 1 week, you know, we might be a little hesitant about coming back again. So the Lord's going to give it to us in small doses. But when he gives his mercy, it ideally is a transformative experience for a whole life. And it can happen in a moment. It's said that a moment spent with a pure devotee actually transforms our lives. Why? Because the beginning is there. The start now of a process of wanting to turn to the Lord, wanting to surrender to him. That process has begun. So, yes, time kind of starts to dilate and disappear a bit also in the realm of devotional service. Because in the spiritual world, there is no sort of debilitating effect of time in that sense. So, Vrindavan Chanakul?
Hare Krishna. I think my question, I had two questions. Both of them have largely been answered. I just wanted to clarify, in terms of empowerment, you know, one would think that the spiritual master would want to empower all of the disciples in one shape or form, like what you just spoke about. But is there something that precedes empowerment? Is it that the guru empowers everyone, or the spiritual master or the Lord empowers everyone, or is it a certain quality or qualification one needs to be empowered?
Both are true, actually. Both are true. They're not really mutually exclusive. The Lord and the devotees in general also distribute their mercy without discrimination. So that when Lord Chaitanya was here in his pastimes, he inundated the entire world with his mercy of love of Godhead. It was available to all. But according to the state of one's actual receptivity in the heart, they could access it differently. So you could say in one sense that one person received more mercy than the Lord. Another way to look at it is that this person was ready and was eager to receive more mercy than another person. So that's one dimension to it, that our hearts is supposed to become like a sponge, and that the Lord's mercy should be soaked up as much as it comes. But if it's already full, if it's already half soaked in water, it can't absorb too much more. If our mind, our consciousness is absorbed in other endeavors, material activities, goals, you know, aspirations, unfulfilled desires in this world, there isn't much space for the Lord's mission, the Lord's desires to enter our heart. That is mercy. So in one sense, it's equally available, but to the extent that we get it is up to us. Now, having said that, there is also a progression of that mercy. And the way that mercy manifests may be different in different ways. The form of that mercy can change also. Sometimes the mercy of the Lord could be, as we read many humorous pastimes in here, he chastises certain devotees. Chastises them, he shouts at them. But they leave completely spiritually entranced. Very difficult to understand it, to comprehend. This is the Lord. He can do anything with any endeavor, any activity. We may engage in Krishna consciousness, and the mercy may be that we are given a chance perhaps to stay in the temple, to render some service to the Lord, to do something in the association of devotees. Maybe just to spend some time with the devotees, so that we are given entrance to a new world of operation, a different world, where the Supreme Lord is at the center, where our unlimited sensory agendas are put to the side. Just to stay in the Lord, in the association of the Lord's devotees is one type of mercy. So often that could be a type of mercy that comes in the beginning. Then later on the mercy could be that the Lord requests you to go to some forlorn place, gives you a thankless task of distributing Krishna bhakti to a group of people who don't like you. That could be a special flavor of the Lord's mercy to come later. If he did that right now, you might not come back for more, as I say. But later on, that will be a relishing challenge for you. And that will happen in a progressive sequence according to our interactions with the spiritual master also. So it is said also that tad vidhi pranipatena pariprashnena sevaya upadikshantite jnanam jnaninas tattva darshina. This is the mood of the relationship one has with a spiritually advanced person. First of all, one offers them their obeisances, surrenders to them, offers them respects. Then one pariprashna, one questions. One offers service also. One questions, one offers service, one follows instructions. That is a wholesome process by which one deepens their relationship, their interaction with their spiritual master, and becomes successively more and more empowered. And so that's a process that happens during our spiritual life. And you can see that could be considered to be increasing empowerment in one sense also. Simultaneously, you can also see that the blockages in your heart, in the sponge, are also being reduced in that process. So whichever way you look at it, our spiritual shakti, our spiritual potency, is supposed to be increasing step by step as we move forward. And the Lord can accelerate it, but our mentality is a major factor in it. When the Lord desires that, when the Lord sees that we are sincere and fit according to His standards now, we've done some serious work on ourselves, He might just empower us, just like He does to all these persons here. He might just transmit some bhakti shakti to us, which allows us to achieve, you know, many years worth of efforts in an instant. You can do that at any time also. Rupa Goswami, who brought to us many scriptures, many books about the Lord's glories, he said that he was directly empowered by Lord Chaitanya. In fact, that was the assessment made about him. That it is impossible for you to write all these literatures, to do what you've done for the Lord, unless you were directly empowered by him. So when we see some great activities, for example, our founder Acharya, at this advanced age, under great difficulties, left his comfortable situation in Vrindavan and traveled around the world, that is something that is symptomatic of serious empowerment. So it's simultaneously, our heart is receptive and the Lord is reciprocating. And so it's an exchange. Thank you. Any other questions? Yes?
Thank you for a wonderful class, Prabhu. Can I ask you, how can we stop asking blessings from the Lord? Because we have this tendency of asking for blessings, and then we know that we're not supposed to be doing that, that we need to offer devotional service without asking something in exchange, but we stop and then we go back into asking for blessings. Can you advise us on how to move away from that?
Yes, well, the injunction to not seek blessings is, it mainly applies to material blessings. Mainly to material blessings.
But like sometimes, like blessings about to have a pacified mind are also material blessings, or subtle material blessings.
Kind of. When a blessing is sought from the Lord, which is aimed at actually furthering our connection with the Lord, even if it may be to purify our mind, it starts to fall into the category of something that's spiritual. So that is one of the interesting features about performing devotional service even in this body. This body is material, we know that. But when we start to utilize this body in the service of the Lord, that body starts to be considered to be spiritualized. Prabhupada gave the example of a microphone. He said, this microphone is just a combination of elements, matter, manufactured with electrical currents flowing through it. It's just a material item. He said, when it is used to transmit the glories of the Lord, it takes on a certain spiritual identity. It's not a physical thing. It's something much deeper than that. Its purpose is now being fulfilled. And it is that energy which all came from the Lord is now being used to establish a connection with Him. That microphone is spiritualized, he said. So when we seek help from the Lord for helping to control our mind, to regulate our thoughts, to develop discipline, that is something like a spiritual desire. And that's something that the Lord doesn't reject. That's endorsed, That's something we're supposed to do. We're supposed to beg the Lord's assistance in this path. Because it's not just a path we traverse on our own. We are here, and it's the Lord pulling us along. So if we ask for His blessings, His help, that becomes part of the process. At another level, you understand that the Lord actually knows everything you want anyway. So on that platform, you might not need to explicitly ask for things. So these are different flavors again. They're not one thing or the other thing. Depending on one's mood, one's interaction with Krishna, the person may just remain silent and just passively accept whatever comes to them. One who patiently accepts the results of his past misdeeds, said in the Bhagavatam, and patiently awaits, all the reactions to manifest, he gets the kingdom of God. It becomes his rightful claim, it said. So that's a dimension. But the desire to actively progress and to seek blessings from the Lord and the devotees is definitely a valid progress. Rather, the advice to not seek blessings largely relates to material things. We want our material opulence to improve. We want to be more beautiful. We want to be, more powerful, control others. Whatever it is we want. These are things typically people turn towards the Lord for. My Lord, give me this, give me that. So those things are not really advisable. But even then, and this should illustrate that spiritual life is not such a black and white thing, it says in the Gita, four types of people surrender to Him. Chaturvidha bhajante mam janasukritin arjuna artha jignasu artha arti gyanicha aratarshava. It says four types of people approach me, those who want wealth, those who want relief from distress, those who are just inquisitive, they want knowledge, and those who want realization of the absolute truth. The Lord still accepts them. It's just what we're discussing is different levels of depth of relationship with Him. So a person who first comes and wants and worships the Lord out of gratitude on the platform of duty and says, "My dear Lord, I want so and so and so, please give it to me. And here's some worship in return." It's okay for that person at that level. It's not the ultimate level of spiritual perfection. It's a rather neophyte level. But it's still a level. And it's still a level where that person is still connected to the Lord. So we have these dynamics in spiritual life. And ultimately, if someone is sincere, then whatever stage they're at, whatever their motivations, they will eventually, hopefully, move to the platform of pure devotional service. Unmotivated, uninterrupted. And that's what we learn, and over time, hopefully, we achieve that.